out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network of Podcasts, the podcast for people who actually like movies, and welcome to our final Oscar Spotlight podcast. We have made it, folks. It has been a very long and winding road to get to this, but we are here to talk about the big prize of the night, Best Picture. We have a full crew for you to talk about this. Hopefully you've gotten the chance to hear all of our Oscar Spotlight movies individually on these films, but we, of course, got to get together one last time and talk about what we think's going to win, what we want to win, and where all of these films belong in terms of the conversation of Best Picture of the Year. And we do have a loaded crew with us today. First off, let me introduce the editor-in-chief of the Front Row Network, Mr. Jeremy Gechner. How's it going, Jeremy?
What is up, everyone? Thanks for... very proud of you guys. What a crazy, chaotic recording schedule. Y'all picked it up, man. Well done.
And also joining us, the associate editor-in-chief of the Front Row Network, Mr. Craig McFarland. How's it going, Craig?
Hey, it's going great. I will say, a little behind the podcast, none of us knew that we were going to be doing these categories until Jeremy announced it to you all in a podcast. So we had already done all these Oscar spotlights of, you know, like 10 films or whatever. And then he's like, we're going to do 8 additional categories. So thank you, Jeremy, for your insights to tell us all about this before we sought out this journey.
You know, I put the bar out there and people clear it or they fall like a bad Olympic athlete meme. And you guys cleared it. You cleared it.
All right. And rounding out our panel for this podcast, the host of Pop Culture Draft Night, Mr. Phil Rockwell. How's it going, Phil?
Good afternoon. Happy to be here.
Good. Excellent. Well, as I said earlier, hopefully if you've been listening to the Front Row Network, you have heard our deep dives into all of these films. So we're not going to spend 4 hours talking. We guarantee this podcast will be shorter than the actual Oscar ceremony. That much I can guarantee you from the jump. Okay. We're just going to go film by film, and I'm going to throw it to our people to talk about maybe some quick reactions in case you haven't gotten to get your thoughts out there about these movies, and also what your take is on the Best Picture. Before we do that, I just want to say this has been a hell of a year for movies, or at least it's in terms of the Academy Awards. I know we've said this a lot on different spotlights, but man, and now that I'm like finally at the end of this, what a banner crop. So I wanted to kind of start with this discussion to see what the temperature of the room is. Where does this slate of Best Pictures, we've got 9 Best Picture nominees, where does this slate of Best Pictures rank with you amongst previous years of Best Picture nominees? Let's start with Jeremy.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because I definitely think this is the best slate of, you know, 9 or 8 or up that we've had since the Academy expanded. It's really hard to find the black sheep of this field. There's no, for those of you who know me, I hate the movie The Blind Side. There's no blind side in this crop of films here. It's all very, very strong. And so eclectic is the other thing. There's just so many different kinds of movies in this whole crop of films. So I can't remember many better ones. Obviously, history will give us more context on that. Maybe, I know in our discussions, we talked about 94 was a really strong year, but yeah, I'm just blown away not only at the quality but the diversity of type of film that we've got in this year's crop.
All right, cool, Craig. How about you?
You know, it's an interesting year. I'm the Disney guy, and Disney owned the box office this year with like 80%, I believe, the domestic box office going to the Walt Disney Studio or to Fox. And so obviously they're represented here with Fox Searchlight bringing on Jojo Rabbit into the Best Picture mix, but outside of that, it's interesting that in such a dominant year for one studio, this quality of film was still released and people were still going out there and seeing all these movies. They may not be making in the billions of dollars. One of our Best Pictures did make $1 billion, Best Picture nominees, but just a really stellar crop of movies. I go back to what Jeremy said. I think 1994 is what I would say. This is the best crop of movies since then. Now, back then, they only had 5 nominees, so we had a fun discussion in our group. What would you cut out of this to say that these are the 5 that would go up against the 5 in 1994? And that's a really hard discussion to have because it's such a strong film year. I really enjoyed seeing all of these. I think it's cool that, you know, people can go back and forth whether or not streaming services are a good idea and what they're doing to cinema. But it is cool that we had access to a lot of these Oscar films prior to the Oscars. Because in the past, if you weren't in a large market, it was really difficult to get your hands on these. But we had Netflix bringing out, what, three of the movies that were, well, two and a half of the movies that we're going to be talking about today. And then, you know, Amazon is stepping up their game. We never know when that first Disney Plus, you know, what they're going to do. I know they're more family oriented, which doesn't necessarily jive with the Oscars, but who knows? They're announcing new content all the time. So it's just really cool, the accessibility of the Oscar films this year as well.
Yeah, I can't imagine at some point Disney's not going to get in on this and at some point invest in, you know, not everything has to be R-rated or edgy. You've got movies like Little Women here or, you know, maybe Little Women's the only one, but not a great year for an example. But yeah, I could totally see, you know, Disney looking to get into the Oscar race on Disney Plus.
Well, next year, I believe it's coming out next year. They're doing a documentary on Howard Ashman called Howard. And that's, you know, even that lane, they just had the Imagineering story, which was a fantastically done documentary on the parks. So anyway, I could talk Disney all day and I won't. But, but yeah, Disney Plus, I think at some point we'll also get in that game.
You're really passionate about Disney, Craig. When we're done talking all these Oscars, maybe you should do a Disney podcast.
Maybe I should.
Yeah, something like that. Now that we're out of our Oscar hole. Okay. All right, Phil, how about you? Where does this lineup of Best Picture nominees rank for you?
Yeah, I it's certainly the best top to bottom of any since The Expanse. And then when you look at, okay, I looked year by year and usually it's five or it's four with one kind of like, this is going to be the one that's forgotten. This year, just the fact that it has nine, and I would argue the possibility that eight of them are long lasting, you know, classic pieces of cinema, based either on what I've seen or you know, what I understand of the ones I haven't seen. The thing that I've found interesting as I've sort of binged a bunch of these over the past several days is I keep running into movies that I think are one thing because they've been nominated for Best Picture. And it turns out they aren't at all what I expect. Marriage Story was a big one. I was expecting something sort of heavy, melodramatic, and that's really not what it is at all. I would put Ford versus Ferrari in the same place, which sure it follows a lot of the tropes of a sports underdog film, but there is also something of a corporate benefiting off of the work of the, you know, the people who actually do the work. So there's more going on there than just, you know, another Hoosiers. Parasite is, I mean, how do you even begin to put a bow on everything that's going on in that movie? And even something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where you think you know Tarantino does this certain thing, and he stepped outside his usual lane and gave us something almost whimsical and melancholy. And so I would say not only is this year great, but it is interesting in very, very surprising ways that I wouldn't on paper would have expected.
Okay, cool, Craig. You said you had one more thing you wanted to add there.
I just noticed, you know, this is a site that I think is near and dear to Phil's heart, but Letterboxd, they have come up with all these lists and their crew came up with the best years for best picture winners. And they actually rank this year number two all time on that site. So just they have a fairly heavy 70s bias. And I was trying to go back and actually look at which year is which. They have 1994 actually rated in the top 12. So it's number 12. Mm-hmm. But then it's the year that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out, which I believe would have been like mid-70s, I think.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's 74, anyway. 75.
Right. So they have that listed number one, but then they have 2019 listed as number two. So I think that's pretty interesting because these are people that are really into film. And even they say this is a very stellar crop of movies.
Yeah, no, 75. That's a, I'm just looking at it right now. That's a hell of a year. That's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Barry Lyndon, Dog Day Afternoon, Nashville, and Jaws. That's a stellar lineup. Yeah, I think I agree with everything that's said, so I don't have much to add other than to, you know, echo what you said, Phil, and that, yeah, I think since we've expanded, the idea of expanding to up to 10 nominees has always been the idea of, well, we need to bring in a couple of more films that people think just missed the cut. And in doing so, oftentimes we've seen in the past 10 years, a little more fat, I guess, is the best way to say it is, you know, when you add up to 9 or 10 nominees, you probably have one or two that are kind of some head scratchers. And this year didn't have that. So I do think it's the best since we've expanded. And that was in 2009. I won't go back as far as 94. The year that I would go to, I'd look at 2004, which is the year that Million Dollar Baby won, but it was also up against The Aviator and Sideways and Finding Neverland and Ray, which are all films that I enjoyed. So that's the one where, to me, there's no real fat there. But I know such things are personal preference, but yeah, I think that's a great point, Craig, and that this is a year that I think the consensus is whether you're wild about each movie on this list, I think there is, there's some justification to that. So having said that, that doesn't mean that we get every single movie on this list that we want to see on this list. So I want to, before we dive into what is nominated, I want to go through quickly and have you all narrow it down to one. Give me one movie that should have gotten this 10th slot. We'll go in reverse order. We'll start with Phil this time.
Knives Out. If we're talking pure craft, every inch of that film is meticulous, well-made, super entertaining, gives a strong commentary on the rich versus poor dynamic, the immigrant story. There's a lot of social stuff going on in that movie. Plus, it's just fun, smart, entertaining film, and it's absurd, but I truly believe that the reason it didn't get nominated is because it is too close to being just pure entertainment. It seems like it has a very sort of pop sensibility when if you actually pay attention, there's a whole lot more going on with that film than sort of the surface level understanding.
All right, Craig, how about you?
Well, I was going to say with what Phil's saying, and it comes out on digital release at I think it's on Friday, and it's really hard for me not to buy it because I do know that Apple likes to discount those movies like 2 weeks later. So I think I'm going to wait and try to save myself a little bit of money, but it's so good. If I had to narrow it down to one, I think I know what Jeremy's going to pick because I actually had three. Phil took one of them. I think Jeremy's taking the other one. I'm going to go with Two Popes. Two Popes is a film that is dialogue rich. It's written extremely well. It's adapted from a play, so I hope it has a chance at Best Adapted Screenplay. And it just dives into those characters, historical figures that we don't know too much about their private and personal lives, and lets us examine those for a little bit. This is something that hasn't happened in the Catholic Church for 700 years. And so it's very likely, almost exceedingly likely, that it'll never happen again in our lifetimes. So just to pull back the curtain on that just a little bit into that process, it's just beautifully done. And it also is a story about two philosophies more than it's a story about two men. They came to this religion, which has the exact same writings. They're all reading the same thing, but coming at it from two completely different worldviews. And by all indications on Gold Derby and all of that, Two Popes was very close, probably, to being the 10th nominee. So I think that the Two Popes should have made the list.
Okay. And Jeremy, how about you?
Yeah, no surprise what I'm going to advocate for. And I know it's fanboyish, but I just don't know, like, if there was ever a time to go for the comic book route, it was last year with Logan. But since we didn't get that, Avengers Endgame, I think, should have been that 10th one. And look, I mean, it's not like there's not a precedent for this. You know, I'm not going to try to compare or contrast them, but it's not like Lord of the Rings Return of the King wasn't, you know, a fantasy epic on the same scale, at least in terms of, you know, production and story epics wise, as Return of the King was. So I'm, you know, I just think that what they accomplished with that movie, you know, some have downgraded it for, you know, its logic or maybe its script or whatever. there was no more pleasing movie going experience this year, I think, than watching Avengers Endgame in the theater and seeing those incredibly iconic scenes that will live on in film history than that. So I think that was deserving of one of these Best Picture nominations. And if any superhero film should get it, I think it's Endgame.
Yeah, I do wonder if we lived in a world where Joker didn't exist, whether there'd be a little bit more of a window for Endgame. I do think that you run the risk of saying, okay, we're going to have two comic book based films in 1 year. And we just got our first one last year with Black Panther. So it almost kind of feels like a little bit of gatekeeping a little bit from the Academy, like, okay, hold on, slow down just a minute here. And we're going to, you know, not to say, and I, you know, that everyone would agree, but I do think, you know, the industry does have a, you know, precedent of giving awards for a lifetime achievement. And so whether you think Endgame is the best MCU movie or not, the achievement that's it gets by landing the plane successfully, which we learned in 2019, real hard to
is hard
your franchise satisfied in a way that satisfies everybody. So I don't disagree with that necessarily. And Phil, you had my other one with Knives Out. I have not seen Two Popes, so I can't back you on that, Craig, other than to say I'm looking forward to see it. But this one changed for me at the last minute. I was ready to go with Dolemite as my name because it was my favorite maybe feel-good movie of the year, which is an odd stance. But the other day I watched Uncut Gems, and I got to say, that movie's not for everybody. I get why it would not be included in this because it is I said it needs to come with its own like chair masseuse to like rub your shoulders while you're watching it because it's like a 2 hour ball of tension. So I get why it's not here because I don't think it's everybody's cup of tea, but man, I'd never seen anything by the Safdie brothers and I'm in now because really I thought that was a high wire tension that just kept getting darker and more tense as it went along and Adam Sandler kind of surprising the world. Like he's always been a talented guy, I think, regardless of some of his choices, but this is something that I never would have seen him do. And I think they use what we know of Adam Sandler and his personal charisma and likability to juxtapose with a character who on paper is just a dirtbag. And so I loved it. And so I wouldn't have been mad to see it sneak in there. But there's a lot of other movies that we could throw in there too. You know, I know if we had Aaron here, she'd probably stump for Rocket Man. I know a lot of people were disappointed there, but really an embarrassment of riches. So let's dive into what is on the ballot this year. And as a reminder, in case you don't follow the Best Picture race, these are 9 movies that are going to be voted on in a tiered system. So it's not like everybody's just going to vote for one. It's a ranked ballot system where the movie with the least amount of, I guess we're off the Iowa caucuses, so the least amount of eligibility gets taken off, and then those first place ballot votes get, and we keep going and going and going until we get a majority consensus winner. So you could have some movie with, only like a 20% consensus win Best Picture, which is sometimes why we can see some upsets. So, and I think we'll dive into that when we get into what we think will win versus what we want to win. But let's break these down and give some quick takes. We're just going to go in alphabetical order here. So we're going to start with Ford versus Ferrari, really the least nominated film on this list, but still in the running for Best Picture. So, Phil, let me start with you. Give your quick take on Ford versus Ferrari and how you think it fits into this Best Picture race.
It's a movie that in a different year would be higher up on the list of movies to earn Best Picture. Right now, it's just it's an extremely well-made film with great acting. I used to hate it when Any Given Sunday came out and the director was like, Oliver Stone said, we want to put you inside the helmet of a football player. Well, having lost a kidney to football, you can't do it. And I thought the same thing about car racing is you can't simulate that. Well, that was before I was holding my breath for minutes at a time watching Ford versus Ferrari on the big screen. When they put you in that seat, and there are moments where you're seeing a wreck in front of you and all you can see is what the driver is seeing that are absolutely harrowing. It's as visceral an experience as I've ever seen in a racing movie. And that's on top of Christian Bale. You know, he kind of falls into a Brad Pitt category where, yeah, he can be a heartthrob, but he's so much more interesting when he's playing someone who's just a little bit off. Matt Damon continues to be just such a solid journeyman actor in his later years. I loved everything about this movie, and it's one of those that I was talking about when I said I thought it was one thing and it was something completely unexpected in a very, very exciting way.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree with you. To me, it does, like I think you said this earlier, Phil, but it does follow a lot of those sports movie tropes. But it shows how well those tropes work when pulled off with master craftsmen at the helm, because you do have two A-list actors who are like absolutely talented professionals, and James Mangold does an excellent job of filming the race scenes, of giving you those character moments, and you know, kind of building the steps to earn its payoff, which some sports movies just kind of assume that you're going to be there for, but it really does work. I love, because it's funny that you mentioned Christian Bale as like a heartthrob type, because I think my brain has shifted into not heartthrob Christian Bale, but method actor Christian Bale, mm-hmm. which is kind of his MO. So like, that was maybe one of my turnoffs to Ford versus Ferrari. When I first heard, I was like, oh, this is going to be some serious car racing movie, because Christian Bale hasn't lightened up in a while. And so to see him do all, like, fully commit to a role in a pretty, by his standards, lighthearted film was really delightful, I thought. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm with you. I was expecting one thing and got something different. And this was the nominee when nominations were announced that I rolled my eyes. I was like, oh, of course, that was gonna
get on the car movie.
Of course, yeah, fine, whatever. You know, but I was pleasantly surprised and think, yeah, I don't really have a problem with it on this list. How about you, Jeremy or Craig? You got any thoughts on Ford versus Ferrari?
It was much better than I had anticipated. I mean, the same thoughts as you, Lou. It was a good movie for dads to go see, too. Like, as yeah. in, like, our generation, like, you know, our dads, maybe grandpas, to go see. Like, they're like, oh man, car movie.
Yes,
it is more than that. But at its core, it's a very cool car movie. You know, so so it's good. It's good.
All right. Yeah, it is funny. You know, the last two movies I saw in the order of this were this one in 1917. So my beta male status is on full display here. Wait until the last minute to see the war movie and the car movie. So, but yeah. All right. Well, let's move on then to Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, one of the most nominated films of the year, but also one that I think momentum has really slowed on this one and is not picking up a lot of awards along the way. And I actually think it's kind of the one that's in danger of being shut out on this list. But let's give it its due. I know I've already talked about this at length, so you can go back and hear our full disclosure, but I absolutely adored this film. I thought it was wonderful. I thought it's a great capstone for Martin Scorsese's career. But you can hear me gush over that film on a different podcast. So I'm going to open up. Let's start with you, Craig. How much sure. do you want to gush over The Irishman?
You know, okay, here's the deal. Here's where it is. There was an awful lot leading into The Irishman. I was really excited when this was announced. And obviously there was some tension and some interviews that were done in the lead up to The Irishman that made me less likely to go and run out and watch it the very first day. Also just life in general. When I'm watching a movie on Netflix, I hardly ever get to watch the whole thing all the way through. So it's just really interesting to me that this movie was able to keep me engaged for the most part. It's very dialogue driven. It's interesting to learn more about Jimmy Hoffa than just he was missing. You know, that's the one thing I knew about him going into this. You have some really stellar performances. I think we disagree. I think Al Pacino probably got the supporting actor nod based on name alone. But Joe Pesci certainly earns his supporting actor nod. And I think Robert De Niro was really left out in the cold in a role where he did a wonderful job. And so it didn't emotionally connect with me as it did with some people. I would encourage people to go back and listen to our full disclosure, because Aaron and Lou, you both describe it in such a way that that really brings that emotion to the movie. And maybe if I would have watched it in one sitting, I would have gotten that too. But it, you know, whenever Martin Scorsese makes a film, you have to give it, that respect to go out and see it. I still like The Departed considerably more than The Irishman, but I understand why there is a bit of love out there for The Irishman as well.
All right, Phil, how about you?
The thing about The Irishman that I was most pleased to see is it seems like as Scorsese has gotten older, the way that he feels about these types of individuals has shifted a great deal. Back in the Goodfellas days, there's a certain amount of reverence for that lifestyle and those types of characters. I think his fondness for them has dissipated, and he ultimately, with this movie, has said that, or is stating that these people live sad, lonely lives. It's the first one. I mean, when you have Robert De Niro's character stuttering through most of the movie, it's each time he's stuttering, it's undercutting that tendency to admire those characters because, well, one, it's De Niro, and two, it's because they're these cool gangster types. Pacino is Pacino, but the thing that struck me about his performance in that movie is this is the first time where it seemed like what Pacino was doing was actually satirizing these man babies who end up at the top of these criminal enterprises. The scene that got memed to death with him throwing a tantrum in the office to me was just like, it was just an example of how sad and pathetic these people really are. They don't have anybody they can trust. They don't take any of the onus for what they do on themselves. It's the lifestyle. It's this, that, or the other thing. They don't accept blame for their own actions. And to me, I just finished reading A Very Stable Genius, a story about Donald Trump's, behind the scenes in the White House up until this point. And the scene where Jimmy Hoffa throws his tantrum seems less and less unrealistic to me. I completely see our commander in chief throwing that type of tantrum in the Oval Office after reading that book. I can understand maybe Pacino hasn't earned that over the last 10 years for me to be able to defend that performance, because it is very Pacino. But in the context of the movie, that's what I felt like. It was just another example of how sad and ridiculous and pathetic these grown ass men are in their lifestyle.
Yeah. The only thing I'll add to that, because I didn't get to add this to the discussion on The Irishman because I hadn't seen it yet, is it actually it encouraged me to go back and watch The Wolf of Wall Street, which I had missed when it first came out, because so much was made about that movie, about it glamorizing the life. And watching it after The Irishman, it really does give you that sense of Scorsese. If there's maybe one thing Scorsese's never done really well, it's satire, because I think there's always been that level of, I believe Wolf of Wall Street was intended to be a satire, but it is like 3 hours of watching the most charismatic actor of his generation living a rock star life, and you're supposed to not like this guy, you know? And so I think in this movie, he does strip away all of that to say, no, like, these aren't good people, and what they do has repercussions. And so it was almost to me trying to trying to finally get to his audience and say, listen, I'm not trying to glorify this life. I'm trying to get you guys to like see that this through a different lens. And so that's all I'll say is that I think this with Wolf of Wall Street makes a very intriguing, but very long double feature. don't drink any water if you intend to do that. Just wake up and start. But anyway, all right. So that's going to get us to our next nominee. And that is Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit. Jeremy, we haven't gotten to hear from you yet, so let's start with you. Let me get your thoughts on Jojo Rabbit and its place in the Best Picture race.
Yeah, so I personally think that Taika Waititi is just a burgeoning genius here. I really do. You know, from his very first couple, the Hunt for the Wilder People, I think it was, and What We Do in the Shadows, it's just all of a sudden you see just this insanely clever wit that this guy has. Then, you know, Marvel scoops him up because that's what Marvel does. And, you know, they find these insanely creative storytellers. And now I feel like Waititi with this one, people are starting to understand a little bit of what the artistry he does there, because he mixes the absurd comedy with the heart-wrenching drama so seamlessly in this movie. I mean, it's just so insane how you can be laughing your butt off for 1 minute and then wanting to punch something out of grief the next moment in a movie like this. And it's filled with these amazing child actors that, and look, I mean, we've all been in theater and stuff. Sometimes child actors are hard to work with. But these guys are, you know, these kids are just really knocking it out of the park here. And Waititi himself as, you know, the imaginary Adolf Hitler is just, I don't know. It's one of those things where you always find these Jewish artists that find ways to poke fun at Hitler. And it always makes fun of me, like him and Mel Brooks and stuff. And it always just kind of amazes me that they're able to do that. But this film, I think, is also just important socially, though, about what it says about nationalism and, you know, identifying yourself in only one way, and kind of the rejection of pluralism in a plural society. So in a way, it gives kind of a more human face to how Nazism and the Reich rose in Germany at that time, and how something like that was capable of happening. So I think even despite its quirkiness, its inherent Waititi-ness, if you will, that is why it deserves a place on this list.
Yeah, I had the viewing experience, and it took me a while to process why I wasn't as high on this movie when I first saw it. And I'm like, well, maybe, you know, Waititi is maybe his sense of humor isn't my sense of humor, and it's an incredibly precise sense of humor. So, in that regard, I'm happy to see it on this list, because I do think it's so great to have such a wholly unique voice represented on here. And we'll get to another very unique voice later on, but it's also the one that during watching it, I wasn't wowed in the way I was by some of these other movies. And but yet it's the one I've thought about maybe as much as almost any other movie. So I'm willing to go back. I kind of feel the way about him the way I did when I was first discovering the Coen brothers, in that it takes me about two or three viewings to determine if I like the movie, or if I, you know, and some of it is to get past the what's going to happen next plot aspect and just to get to the humor of the movie and see if the humor lands with you. And so, yeah, I'd agree with everything you say there, Jeremy. I think he's definitely, if you haven't seen this movie yet, I think it's worth checking out. If you've avoided it because it seems a little off, it is a little off, but I think it's interesting, and it may not work for everybody, but it's certainly interesting. Craig, how about your thoughts on Jojo Rabbit?
Yeah, I'm one of those people it didn't work for. But, you know, I mean, I understand. I totally understand what it was going for. Maybe like you, Lou, I need to go back and reexamine it. You know, trying to watch like all nine of these, plus a couple of the other ones that also drew in nominations, all within the last like basically two or three weeks. I just didn't have enough time maybe to really fully grasp it and understand it. But I can totally see. I represent that group of people that are, for me, it's a head scratcher more than it is a potential Best Picture nominee. But again, that might change over time.
All right. Well, let's go from your head scratcher to my head scratcher. I think we all have one. So
wait, could I use my head scratcher on this one too?
Sure. Well, sure. No, you only get one, Craig. You can only scratch your head once on this podcast and you will like it. No, but let's get to it. Let's get to the easily the most polarizing movie on this list. And that is Todd Phillips's Joker. I know we're going to have some polarizing opinions because we had, I know Jeremy on your best of list, you had this as one of your best dramas, but also on our website, Phil, you wrote a very pretty pointed review of it. So I'm going to let you guys, you know, you guys go for it. Phil, let's start with you.
Okay. So
Do we have a ring bell sound effect here?
I should have really been on the full disclosure with this, just so I could sort of lay out responses to some of the things that Jeremy and Jay, right? Jeremy and Jay said.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
my issue with Joker is that I don't think it lands on a point of view about what the Joker does. Structurally, it is set up to make us sympathize for Arthur Fleck. They show every single person in his life essentially turn on him. The social safety net fails him. Psychiatry fails him. His mother fails him. So everything is set up to sympathize with him. And the problem with that is, where is the line between sympathizing with him and feeling that he's justified in taking the actions that he takes? When we say that we don't, I know Jeremy said he doesn't empathize with him. And I understand that, because Jeremy is a sensible human being. You can't sympathize and empathize with the actions that Joker takes. The problem is, I don't think the film is as clear as it needs to be on that point, that he is not a person that we should sympathize with. The line at the end where he says, "What happens when you essentially leave someone in the wind?" And his response is, "You get what you deserve." And then he shoots a guy in the head. And my question was, what did he deserve besides taking some shots at a guy who sucked at stand-up comedy? Like, there's a problem with scale there. And if you truly want to say that, like, his philosophy is completely incoherent when you actually sort of take what he's saying. And the script, if you read the script, which I did, it's worse. Then the film needed to make some different choices. To me, at the end, by not taking a stand one way or the other on how you feel about what Arthur does, it misses an opportunity to say something more. And it just leaves the film in this limbo that, when we're dealing with this sort of topical, violent extremism, to me, it's a little distasteful.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. Jeremy, your take.
Oh, and I do agree with Phil on that. His article is insanely well-written and well-argued. You know, there's a lot of issues with the film, but it's hard, and Phil even says this in the article, it's really hard to let it go from the performance at the center of it. Yeah. Because it is that good. It is, you know, Phoenix is just doing remarkable work here. And, you know, when you see that, and when you start to think about what Phil so eloquently does think about, you know, you do start to see the inherent problems of it. The reason why I listed it as my favorite drama was because the inherent drama that is literally, when you just kind of look at Arthur's drama himself, just in, you know, how people have to deal with these kinds of mental issues, I think that's enough for me to say, you know, there's a lot of great skill and craft going on here, showing a dramatic point of view. But yeah, the problems with the film, and especially when, as he said on the award circuit and in interviews, the filmmakers really kind of wash their hands of the kind of, you know, misinterpretation that they think there can be. And you really didn't, quite earn that. Even if you did show us a truly complex version of why somebody would go to the lengths that they go to. And, you know, it's not like it's just, oh, something bad happened to me. You know, I'm committing violence.
Right.
It's complex. There's a lot of stuff that has to happen to this guy throughout the course of his entire life to get him here. So, but yeah, I just think that though the performance is like 85% of the movie, and it's hard to, for anyone to argue that that's not, you know, something quite amazing to behold there.
Yeah. I listed, as you're hearing this, my article of my best picture ballot ranking these will be out that you can read. But my opening to Joker is that I think this is a rare instance where a performance is so good it actively ruins the film.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Because he gives so much depth to a character and does so much heavy lifting that, you know, you kind of feel this movie's about more than it really is. And I think the screenplay, I think he elevates the screenplay to a height it never itself reaches.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, he broke the movie because the guy is, in real life, that guy would just be a straight up psychopath.
Right.
And if we don't, if Phoenix isn't that good, then that's all he comes off as, and we don't care. Mm-hmm. The problem is we care, and then we feel weird about it because the filmmakers are kind of like, that's on you if you care about this guy who eventually just murders people.
We talked a lot about it already, but my complaint, my beef with the movie is that to me it's not an adaptation of Joker at all. It was Todd Phillips wanting to write a script about a man named Arthur who could have been just this movie stripped away from the Joker at all is honestly, it would have still been just as Oscar baity as this movie is. And maybe it wouldn't have made $1 billion, but at the same time, you know, it's weird to try to line this film up with the mythos of the Joker, because I think you need Batman there. That's why to me, Gotham never really worked for me. But if you think about it in, you know, in this timeline, the Joker is going to be like 70 when Batman is like actually really doing his thing. And they're talking about doing a sequel to it. It just, you know, everything about it, to me, I said this to Jeremy the second after I watched it, I said that to me, this works just as well as a Norman Bates origin story as it does a Joker origin story. It's any psychotic individual that this could work towards. And so that's my main beef, is that the Oscars can now say, we awarded a comic book movie, it's the most nominated, when in true fashion, it's really not a comic book movie. It has very little to do with the actual character of the Joker.
Yeah, Todd Phillips has a history of being a cynical, having a cynical view of the film industry. He's made a lot of funny movies, by the way. You know, he made Road Trip and Old School, and then he did the Hangover movies, but he knew exactly what his audience wanted, and that's what he gave them. And then he did two more Hangover movies, you know, very cynically, just kind of like doubling down on everything. I think he knew that the only way to get this movie made and to actually make some money with it is to shoehorn in a comic book mythos. And I think you're exactly right, Craig. I think this is a movie about a guy who just happens to turn into a recognizable pop culture character without ever really kind of, you know, being about his place in the world that we know him to be in. So I agree. All right, so let's move on to something completely different, because I think we could go on. We can make this a 2-hour Joker podcast if we want to, but let's move over to our next nominee. Again, another wild shift. We're going to go to Greta Gerwig's Little Women, an adaptation, one of many. I know Jeremy and Sarah have gotten to have their take on it, so I'm going to open it up to Craig. Let's get your thoughts on Little Women.
Absolutely. You know, what I find interesting is the critique of this film coming into it, having not been able to see it yet, but just listening to other podcasts and things, where if you don't know the source material very well, The way it's edited might be confusing for you. And I disagree with that because I've never read Little Women. I saw some of the 1994 film, mainly just because it would be on like TNT or whatever the case may be when I was younger. But this is truly the first time with this material, and I thought it was extremely well done. I know that Jay mentioned in our talk during the best adapted screenplays, it is a confusing choice to have the same actresses play the little girls or little women, and also them later in their teens, 20s, just because it takes just a second to figure out exactly what they're doing with the timeline and things like that. But really cool adaptation and really neat way to bring a story back to life and really give it some resonance to continue on. And I think it easily deserves its place in the Best Picture category. And Greta Gerwig, she's just on a roll. Mm-hmm. I mean, her and Noah Baumbach, they're like the power couple of Hollywood, right? And mm-hmm. just really crushing it with this writing and especially her with her direction. We could probably talk for an hour on whether or not she should have got into director. And I haven't had a chance to listen to your folks' director conversation yet, and I'm sure that's brought up. But Little Women is a wonderful choice for Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, I would agree. And I was somebody, interestingly enough, I watched this with my wife and my 9-year-old daughter. Neither of us had seen the previous iterations of Little Women or read the book, which is kind of remarkable for the whole house to be 0-3 there. And I would agree. I do think the shifting of times does take a little getting used to in the beginning, but it settles in. You know, I think give it a good 15, 20 minutes in, I think he gets over that and really then does become it's an excellent device. The device works the longer you sit with the film. And I do think I could see how it might be confusing for some, but also refreshing for others who have sat through four other versions of Little Women and know those beats by heart to kind of recontextualize those beats and make you a little bit more familiar with it. So I love this movie. And I thought for a movie based off a book that's very old, based off of films that have done, Gerwig does such a good job of writing it so that it still feels very of the moment. And I think that's the best thing you can say about an adaptation is when it honors the original, it doesn't change much. There's, I think, maybe only one plot point that really shifts, but it doesn't change much. But the way that it's presented and the way that it's executed feels like it justifies its own existence, which I think remakes sometimes have a hard time doing. You know, we sit there like, well, why did they remake this? It just feels so much like the previous version. And I think, for better or worse, this one certainly doesn't do that. So yeah, I'm happy with it. In the Best Picture category, Gerwig. Yeah, that's a hard one because it is such a, again, when you have so many good movies this year, you would have liked to see at least one female director recognized, at the same time, this year is just a banner year for film too. I think go ahead, Phil.
Can I say one thing as a person who hasn't seen the movie?
Sure.
I bend the knee to Florence Pugh. Her performance in Midsommar, probably because it's genre, and we know how the Academy gets hives when they think about nominating genre films. But her performance in that is one of the best of the year. I'm glad that she got nominated for Little Women. She is going to be an amazing actress to watch. Mm-hmm. She seems to have a courage, a fearlessness that I think maybe it may just be a British thing. I don't know, but it seems like most American actresses have to get into their 30s before they start showing this type of courage in their roles. Florence Pugh is great, and I'm sure she'll be great she's great in Little Women. She's just incredible.
She may be joining the Avengers soon. You know, you never know. with Black Panther right around the corner.
That's right.
Not Black Panther, Black Widow.
Black Widow. Black Widow.
Cool. Well, you mentioned Gerwig's spouse or partner, Noah Baumbach. So let's talk about his movie, Marriage Story, which is nominated, I believe, for 6 awards, including Best Picture. I've gotten a chance to gush about this one on our Oscar Spotlight, so I don't have a whole lot to add to this. You can go back and find that. But just know, I adore this film. I really did find it to be maybe, of all of these films, the most personal and the most human of these on this list. It's the smallest in scale. But other than that, you know, you can go back and hear me talk at length about that. So I'm going to open it up and let's start with you, Craig.
Sure. To me, you know, I kind of strapped in for this one because people said it is so emotional, but it's emotional in the right kind of way. It's not just only to break you down and for no other purpose. It's done in an extremely human fashion. And this is where I think, you know, you all gushed about Joaquin Phoenix's acting, and surely it looks like he's the odds on favorite to win. But if I had a bold Oscar prediction, and maybe this is more of my heart than my head, but I think Adam Driver deserves it. He really brings a character that, and this may be because I'm a man, I really sympathize with his character throughout maybe like 3/5 of the movie, or maybe even longer than that. And then suddenly you realize that his character is so emotionally abusive to Scarlett Johansson's character. You start to think like, well, and you see it just little bits and pieces and glimpses, and you kind of understand how this marriage fell apart. And so it just a remarkable job by both of them. I'm glad that they both got acting nominations for it. And I really wish, we've been talking about this on the thread, but it does seem like Netflix has decided in their marketing that they're going to produce some memes and they're going to try to get people talking about things online. I think that was really to the detriment of Marriage Story. Whereas a film like Irishman, when you start to meme it, that allows it to become more in the public consciousness and really to get it out there because it's kind of your mega hit of the year. But Marriage Story, they started to make these memes and marketing it that way. And it really truly ruined one of the major scenes of the film because they decided to make it into a joke. So bad on you, Netflix, but just extremely well-written, extremely human, and well-acted. It's just a masterclass in acting by the two leading performances, and just tremendous film.
All right, Phil, how about you?
Yeah, this may seem like a little thing, and maybe it's just it's just me. There is something to me in terms of acting that it seems like we underrate people's ability to just be in a space. Marriage Story, the way they walk around the house and the apartment, there's a familiarity there that is so vital to the story, where these people are so intimate with each other. It's the whole, you know, finish each other's sentences thing. To me, Scarlett Johansson was a revelation in this. For someone who started her career largely because she was very good looking, had this tremendous sex appeal. Then she's in the Avengers. I think we've been sleeping on an incredible talent, more than ever, anybody in that movie. Like, I shouldn't be able to buy one of the biggest movie stars in the world as a soccer mom. But just the way she interacts with the kid, and the way she makes herself feel small and then sort of blossoms as she realizes that she'd been handcuffing herself. It's just this remarkable thing to watch. Adam Driver is great in sort of the same ways, where it's some of the hardest acting to do is act like a normal human being, because you get in your head is like, okay, I'm acting, but I can't act like I'm acting. And you just, like, that's one thing you can say about Joaquin Phoenix's performance is you can hide behind histrionics. You can't hide behind making a peanut butter sandwich or getting a glass of water. These little things that automatically ring false if you do them in a weird way. And it's I just, my jaw was on the ground watching these movie stars seem like my neighbors. And that's so vital. Like you realize that the core of this movie is these are people just like us that just fell apart. It's another one of those movies. I thought it was a certain thing because of the meme. Mm-hmm. And I was floored, by what I found. It's one of those, you're putting one of those best picture, predicaments where do I go with this complicated, you know, big budget, flashy picture, like a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or do I credit this smaller movie that is doing quote unquote simpler things, but does them in such a devastatingly human way and relatable way. It's one of those movies that confounds my best picture pick just because which is harder. I don't know, but I, considering how quote unquote little they did in that movie, and the amount I was blown away, Mare's Story floored me.
People have talked about the apartment scene so much, and that's the scene that we're alluding to that's been memed to death online. But mm-hmm. I would say that for me, one of the most powerful scenes in the movie is when the social worker is coming in to see, to observe Adam Driver as a dad, and he's just so nervous. You can just see the tension, and then he ends up cutting himself. And he has to hide that from the social worker. And more importantly, he has to hide it from his son. So he ends up basically passed out on the kitchen floor and just trying to hide the fact that he's like gushing blood from his son. And like, it just, you put a very fine point on it. You know, Phil, we like to award people playing humans as long as that human is already dead. So we love biopics. We love to give acting awards to biopics, but hardly ever do they give awards for just being human and just really just acting. I'd say Octavia Spencer for Fences is probably the last time that somebody's just awarded for true life acting and not just playing a character or being a method person or playing someone that has already passed away, or in the case of like Elton John this year, I know Taron wasn't nominated, but Elton's still alive. But we love those biopics, mm-hmm. you know, but we can't just allow people to play honest to God, true life characters and get some recognition for it, which is why I would love it if one of the two of these ended up winning over Renee Zellweger or Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, I think if there's an upset to be had, if it were in one of those two, I'd be a happy guy too. Yeah, I think you both hit it very well. So let's go from the smallest movie on this list to the biggest, and we'll go with Sam Mendes' 1917. Man, I said this on the Marriage Story pod as well, but man, I think if you had to find the two most disparate films on this list, it might be these two, like the two films that just are so extreme in what they're going for in terms of their experiences. And so I'll start with that. And I'll just say, you know, everything that you said about Marriage Story, I 100% agree with. And it's all things that I found were kind of lacking in 1917. You know, it is so much... so much of these movies are about, you know, so much film is such a wide swath of what it can be. And I think these two movies paired up against each other show you really what the two films can do. And in Marriage Story, it's this very personal story. 1917, it's almost completely impersonal in the fact that I don't know if you ever hear the main characters' names. You don't get much time with their backstories. You don't learn, you know, and so the experience is watching this single unbroken take, or at least what we're led to think is an unbroken take. Obviously there's edits involved of depicting World War I. And for me, I know this is the front runner. We'll get to our picks later, but it seems so interesting to me that a movie that's filled with so much that a list that is filled with so many like character driven films, that this is the one that's leading the pack, because to me, it's the least character centric of them. Now that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad movie. I don't think that, but it's interesting to me to see how that's happening in a movie that's driven. This film to me seems to be driven mostly by the immersion and the spectacle of being put on the front lines and walking through these characters. And so for me, it was good for that, but then it's maybe the movie I've thought least about since I watched it. Craig, what about your thoughts on 1917?
You know, I think that there's, I'm the guy that really complained an awful lot about Dunkirk having no true plot and not no connection to the characters. And I would push back on what you're saying, Lou. I do think that you get a sense of exactly what you're going after here in these characters, because you're actually walking next to them and with them the whole way. You do develop some kind of bond with these two, especially, you know, I don't want to get too into spoilers in case somebody hasn't watched it, but the things that happen along the way are impactful in that way. And it does have some payoffs at the end as well. Specifically because of that. So I would push back that you do get a general sense that you have a good, decent plot storyline going on here. And it's also just a revolution in terms of filming. Mendez, in my mind, does deserve the Best Director nod over the director of Parasite, because to me, I kind of joked about it before seeing this movie. I said, well, you know, video games have been doing this for the last 20 years, so it's good that movies are going to try. But this truly was an experience, and it was very well done, and it could have came off very cliche, and it didn't. And it could have distracted from the movie, and it really didn't. There were times where I was like, I wish that they would cut away from these two just so I can learn a little bit more backstory. But then the whole experience of it from start to finish was just harrowing. It was very very well done, well shot movie. And I'll be happy. You know, we're going to talk predictions later. But I'm happy that it's getting the recognition that it does.
All right, Phil. I know you haven't gotten a chance to see it, but you had a question about it.
Yeah. I haven't seen 1917, but last weekend I watched They Shall Not Grow Old, which is a documentary Peter Jackson made that used archive footage from World War I to they digitally remastered everything. And to me, World War I is about rotting in a hole for 6 months to a year, going through the seasons, just lying in the mud. And everything I've seen of 1917 is a larger scale than how I envision the World War I. Is it flashier than your understanding of what the World War I sort of ethos was?
So to me, I understand what you're saying, because I saw the trailers as well prior to going into this. And I think it'd be interesting if you were someone that was claustrophobic, how this movie would affect you, because the tight shots in the trenches really do give you the sense of just how dirty and gross this war really was. And, you know, that's what's interesting to me about the one shot, is that you're walking from, you know, you might be walking several hundred meters and having to interact with over 200, 300 different extras, and none of them can screw it up, you know, or you're going to have to reset the shot. And obviously they edited together a lot of things, but they still had very long one shots. And so walking through those trenches together, there's a one point in the film that's not shown in the trailers, but doesn't give too much away. Our main character is walking against the grain of the other soldiers in the trenches. And to me, it gives you the sense of the amount of space that you're working with, and also the fact that these things would have been built over months' time, and because you're going to stay there for months at a time and live in these holes, basically. So I do think that it gives you a better – I can totally understand your critique Because I remember you see the big glorious shots in mm-hmm. the trailer, and you don't really get the sense of that small, more intimate shot like you do in the actual movie.
Yeah, I would say to that, I think there are a lot of claustrophobic moments in the film. I think it's not a film though about the passage of time that occurs during World War I, because it basically, since it's one shot, kind of takes place over the span of maybe like 24 hours, I think, is what it happens. So it doesn't give you maybe that sense of what you're asking, Phil, of, you know, having to spend months in a trench, or give you like there. And there's also not necessarily, because the characters are constantly in motion, we don't really, I don't know if we ever get the weariness of that, of the 6 months that exists there, but I don't think that's what the film's going for. To me, I think what the film is going for is to talk about maybe the relentlessness of war, where mm-hmm. you don't have time to stop sometimes, to think, to mourn, to process things. You have to get from one thing to another because of what is at stake. And that's where I like the one shot element of it, because I do think it has that immersion. I think for me, it just loses it by doing so. We don't spend as much time with the characters as I would prefer. Like we get in, say, like a Saving Private Ryan, which is has some very spectacular moments, but then also builds some really interesting character stuff too. So I guess that, you know, it's a different style of war movie than really anything we've seen. But I think to get to that point, no, it's not a passage of time movie in the sense that it's maybe it's a passage of real time movie. Okay, so let's move on then to our next film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's ode to the late 60s, and a movie that I think is probably going to walk away with a couple of different trophies, but let's get a round table and a discussion of it. Jeremy, we haven't heard from you in a minute, so let's let you start off on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny to me. It's like the more of these movies I see, this is going to sound bad, but like the further down Once Upon a Time drops for me, and it's not a bad thing. It's just a really good year. You know, Tarantino seems to, like, as he is self-proclaimingly winding his career down, seems to be getting a little bit more thoughtful in how he's presenting some of his stories. And what I love about this film in particular is just the love that he clearly has for this era of Hollywood. And, you know, Tarantino's obviously such a cinephile, and he has such a great love for movie history, but the way that he kind of gives a love letter to the stars of the past, and how, you know, after, you know, these people of such a different bygone era, and just the way that the film starts with, you know, the commercial for and the interview and the commercial for I can't remember, like Bounty Law, I think is what the name of the show was. And it is just such of a time and place. And even just more than that, the performances are great, but I love the, There's an inherent melancholy too to the film and how it portrays Sharon Tate, because Margot Robbie obviously does great in portraying her, but the movie and the way Tarantino tells the story is that it gives you just this love for who she was, and also just this profound sadness for what was lost with her, with the dastardly acts of the Manson family. And that's always kind of playing in our mind, you know, even though, you know, we're all kind of just waiting for it, when the big moment hits, and when the revisionist history and Glorious Bastards moment hits, it is so amazingly satisfying and horrifying at the same time, which is also just a Tarantino staple. So the movie I think is good, but I think I don't know. It's not as memorable to me as some of the other ones here, but it definitely deserves its place as one of the 9 nominees, I think.
100% agree. Actually, there was probably no one on earth who was less interested in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood than me, because I haven't enjoyed any of Tarantino's films. It's just the way he does them. They're overly grotesque to me. They're overly violent. They're overly vulgar. And so going into this film, I wasn't overly excited. And then actually I cheated and I listened to the Full Disclosure that Phil hosted with some folks, with Brian from After the Hype, and then also with Aaron. And really, they gave me a sense of like, okay, this, I really do need to go see this film. And it's so interesting because to me, this film doesn't turn into a traditional Tarantino film until the last 10 minutes of the movie. Before that, it's extremely well written. And now I'm not saying he doesn't write well, but extremely well written. And he does a good job of developing these characters and really painting the scene of what it was like in Hollywood at this time for someone that was kind of ending their career and the impact that that had on them. The monologue or the dialogue between Leo and the little girl, you know, that little girl could have been nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a lighter year. She did a phenomenal job handling that. And especially when you think she's on set with, you know, the biggest movie star in the world, and she's delivering something like that. Just an absolutely incredible movie. And I think even if you don't necessarily like Tarantino because of the violence, because of the vulgar nature, honestly, if you just turn off the movie with 10 minutes to go, you're not going to get that. So, you know, and it's just a really well done ode to a bygone era. And I would pair it. It pairs very well with the Manson season of, You Must Be Remember This, the Karina Longworth podcast. So that's, I really enjoyed it.
We've got it now on record here, Craig liking a Tarantino movie. Yeah. I'm glad we did this. If we did nothing on this podcast, we've done something.
That's what we accomplished this year.
One of us. What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I have an hour and a half long conversation on the full disclosure of this. Which is probably my favorite thing I've done for the Front Row yet, because instead of us going up or down, did we like it or not? We had a discussion about the things that the film raises, the questions that it raises. I have a feeling, Jeremy, I'm kind of on your wavelength where, you know, after you get hit with a Parasite and, even not nominated movies, Knives Out, Once Upon a Time has a tendency to slip. Where I think it's going to end up is one of those movies that I'll revisit every couple years and go, oh yeah, this was an incredible film. And the one thing I do want to note about it is Leonardo DiCaprio, for me, is where my heart is for best actor, because I'm pretty sure he is the first Tarantino character who ever stuttered, because his dialogue is so sharp and so precise that if you're stuttering through his dialogue, then it's missing its juice. Just the fact that he would open it up to a character that isn't very well spoken, that stutters and sputters, and my favorite moment of just pure performance of this year is Leonardo DiCaprio breaking down in his trailer, drinking too much.
So good. Yeah.
And you know, there's something special about one of the biggest movie stars in the world being so willing to just show his ass over and over and over in this movie. And I think it's the first Tarantino movie where I actually had genuine affection for the characters rather than just thinking, oh, these guys are cool and they're smart and sharp and they talk cool. And I genuinely am in love with Leonardo DiCaprio's character in that movie, which is a new thing for Tarantino. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree in the grand scheme of things, I wasn't walloped by it like I was some of these other films, but I have genuine affection for it.
Yeah, I think if the end of the day, this is one of the oddly most rewatchable films on this list, which is an odd for a Tarantino movie, because a lot of times, like you've pointed out, Craig, you know, I'm way higher on him than you are, but there is a kind of a mood you've got to be into, even if you like Tarantino, to sit down and be like, hey, I want to watch, you know, Kill Bill, where, you know, and watch 100 people get mercilessly slaughtered or whatever, you know.
It's black and white, so it's okay, man.
Right,
it's okay.
But it's like in this one, it's so you could put this, this and Ford versus Ferrari are like neck and neck for the two, like the TNT annual awards, in that, you know, if it's on cable on the afternoon, you'll click it on and watch it, and it will work, I think, on, you know, and I think it works more and more repeat viewings for me. And I'll say this in my article a little bit. I liked it better the second time, because when I watched the first time, there's a tension looming over the film for me, wondering what is going to happen to Sharon Tate. Is he going to go the alternative route? Is he going to, you know, is it going to end badly or whatever? And I didn't know that. And then I see how it ended. So then the second time I watched it, I was able to let just kind of the hangout vibe of the movie work for me. And it works, you know, it works really well. So yeah, I'd agree with both of you. I think it's not my pick. It's not at the top. It's like right in the middle to upper middle of the pack for me. But yeah, it's still, it's really well done. So that gets us to our final nominee of the podcast, and that is Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, a movie that seems to be has a lot of kind of momentum as this dark horse best picture. It would certainly be a historical win if it wins Best Picture as the first foreign language film to ever win Best Picture. It's up for Best Director. It's best for Best International Film. It's up for a lot of different things. And I'm gonna put a rule on it right now. I think this is gonna be the one I think we're gonna avoid. Try to avoid spoilers as best we can, because this is also, I think, the least seen of all of our pictures so far. It hasn't made a ton of money. And if it does, if there's any bounce it'll be after Best Picture. So
also, without getting, I haven't myself seen it. So,
okay, yes. Well, perfect. So see, for you're welcome, Jeremy.
Yeah, there we go.
Did that just for you.
No, I hear the last 20 minutes of this movie is just, I hear the last 20 minutes is so bonkers that I'm saving it for last. So.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, last year, the last movie I watched right before the ceremony was Green Book, and it ended up winning. So, you know, maybe there's some sort of front row.
Yeah, same thing as this movie. Yeah.
So it was your fault, Lou.
It is.
It's Lou's fault.
Don't blame me on that one. That's fine. but yeah, let's open it up and let's talk about Parasite. Craig, what were your initial thoughts on Parasite?
I don't want to say too much about it because, honestly, the only thing I knew about this film going into it was that it wasn't about, it wasn't going to be like a Contagion type film. It wasn't like a true Parasite. Literally, that's all I knew. And I'm so glad that that's all I knew, because it, to me, is the most impactful film of the year. It has so many layers. You could talk about it. I mean, you could study this film more than any other film, I think. It's beautifully done, and it deserves all the accolades it's getting. And again, I know we're going to talk about our picks here in a second, so I don't want to like step on what I'm going to say in that, but just a remarkable piece of cinema. And I highly encourage you, don't let the subtitles scare you. Go out and watch it.
All right, Phil, how about you?
I think it's nothing short of a masterpiece. It's the closest thing we've gotten to a Hitchcock movie since Hitchcock died. Not only is it twisty and you know, just a compelling sort of narrative, you have this social commentary going on between rich and poor, which we've determined has been quite the theme this year between Knives Out, Parasite, Ford versus Ferrari has it. I mean, it's
Hustlers.
Yeah, there's this class division thing that has been a fairly prevalent theme. It's one of those movies, when you see it, the running joke is my wife walked in at the halfway point of this movie. she walked in when the maid returned and rang the doorbell. That's where she started this movie. And there is such exactly right. There is such a tone is one of the hardest things to capture. You know, a truly great director can maintain his tone. Like even Joker, the tone is consistent throughout the movie. Well, Bong Joon-ho does that, and then at the halfway point, he decides I'm going to shift the tone entirely and master a new tone. He does things that I think would scare the hell out of American Studios. He's a guy who's been daring in Korea for forever. Most of his films are start off as like he directed a movie, The Host, which you think is about this, you know, a kaiju type Godzilla movie, which really is a kaiju movie masking a family drama. Mm-hmm. Like, he just does not subscribe to convention. He's just the fact that in the internet age where we're all used to predicting the next step in a saga, whether it's Game of Thrones or Lost or Westworld, that he can stay 2, 3, 4 steps ahead of us throughout the entire movie is incredible. It's just an absolute masterclass of filmmaking. And when he can make one of the most devastating shots of the year, a shot of a floor and the bottoms of a guy's feet just barely in frame and take your breath away. I mean, and he's so humble about it. Like, oh, hell yeah, I made a movie. No, you didn't just make a movie. I mean, you made this incredible thing. So we should all be falling in love with Bong Joon-ho. And if you're afraid of subtitles, what are you doing with yourself?
Really? Yeah. And I'll just, like I said, I haven't seen the movie yet because I want to save it for last. And the reason why I wanted to save it for last, because Phil, you talked about it. Bong Joon-ho is perhaps the best director working right now. And he's like, you rightfully called out The Host, which is just fantastic. Everybody see it, but you know, Snowpiercer, Okja, and now this, like, he's on a run here that's quite unrivaled. And you're right. It's just like, there's a reason why stars of Hollywood keep finding their way to work with this guy,
right?
Because he is that good. And he's been one of my favorite directors, as you said, ever since The Host. I think like 2006 is when that came out. And I was like, okay, I see this guy. And then, you know, Snowpiercer happens, and I'm just like, wow, this guy's really, really blossoming into something. And like you said, with the subtitles, he even mentioned that in I think the SAG Awards speech or somewhere where I can't remember which award, but the line, I'm going to butcher it in his speech, but he said, you know, you'll find that once you get over the 1-inch thing that is subtitles, that you find a ton of great cinema or something like that. And yeah, if ever there was a movie that could do it, I think this might be the one, especially with the tiered voting system in Best Picture. You might have a shot with this one. It's got some momentum behind it.
I'm on board with everything you guys are saying, and I won't get any deeper into it to try to, you know, so people don't try to like parse our words and try to figure out what's going on with this movie, because I do think it really deserves to be a movie that you know see how it unfolds and allow that surprise to happen and to be surprised by where the film goes. And it's not, and I want to be clear too, we're not talking about like a Sixth Sense or a Usual Suspect. No. It's like, oh, the whole plot is bound up in this twist. I don't think it's a twist so much as it is a shift. We won't say what the shift is, but a shift happens that does kind of change what you think you've been watching up till that point. And so also in that regard, it's not like a Sixth Sense, which, you know, maybe you don't have a desire to go back and rewatch once you know the twist. But yeah, in this one, I think there's plenty to go back for. And I think one of the things that I love about this movie is I do think because people are going to get to see it, and it's got, whether it wins or not, the platform it's been given by all of the awards that it's getting does make me feel like, okay, maybe people will not only let Bong Joon-ho make more films, which we need him to do, but inspire future filmmakers, which is always one of the benchmarks that I look at when I look at Best Picture nominees and maybe what I would want to see win Best Picture. So now that we're there, let's get there. Let's do it. We've talked about all these movies, so let's go and try as expeditiously as we can. Go through our head and heart picks for Best Picture. What do you hope wins Best Picture, and what do you think is going to win Best Picture? Well, let's start with Jeremy.
It's strange to say this, but because it's a movie I haven't seen, but my heart is that Parasite wins. And not just because, again, I already told you about my love for Bong Joon-ho. I'm just, everybody talking about it and the critics and such, I'm expecting that I'm going to see a masterpiece. And so, you know, in that sense, it would also just mean a whole lot, I think, for the Academy and for the direction, really, I think we all want it to go in, and what I think a good segment of the new members of the Academy wanted to go in, which is just, let's open this up, you know, like, let's not just, you know, limit ourselves to a certain kind of film and see that there is just some amazing stuff happening all over the world. You know, the Academy with the best foreign language film, international film category now, they wanted that. They wanted to encourage other countries to start making cinema on the level that we've been spoiled here with in America for forever. And it's happening. It's happening all over the world. And I think, you know, I think of like the White Ribbon from Germany a few years ago, too. There is some amazing cinema happening right now outside our borders. And I think it would mean so much in that regard to see Parasite win that. Head, I think it's probably going to be 1917. And that's fine. It's an amazing film. It just blows you away. And the technical mastery alone of what they accomplished there is quite amazing. So I think Heart, Parasite, Head, probably 1917.
All right, Craig, how about you?
I'm going to flip the script on Jeremy. I'm going to say that in my head, I think Parasite's going to win. I think that it deserves to win. I think that it's a masterpiece. The reason why I say that is because it seems like it has such momentum behind it in Hollywood. The fact that this is coming off of the Green Book year, I think that that gives it some momentum to say, like, this could be an international film that could win Best Picture. It's really timely, really relevant. In my heart, I think 1917 should win because to me, it was an absolute masterpiece of a war movie. You know, it's a different take on it. They did the one shot. Mendez has that connection to his grandfather with World War One. It's just an absolutely incredible film overall. If I could put in an honorable mention, there's no way it's going to win. If I had a no way it's going to win, but I'd be love it if it did, it'd be Marriage Story, because that's another just incredibly well-written piece about a very human process and a very human dynamic that unfortunately a lot of relationships end up having to deal with.
All right. And how about you, Phil?
So our spreadsheet doesn't lock until the award ceremony starts, right?
Correct.
So my heart is with Parasite. I've talked about it on way too many podcasts at this point. And I think it's going to win. Parasite is the only movie. I mean, it's been in the zeitgeist for a good 6 months, and it's never had that fade, that moment where the hype catches up to it and it just sort of like, Parasite, you know, whatever. 1917, just knowing how the head games that Academy voters play with themselves, I think it's going to get a lot of technical awards that are well-deserved, and people are going to give their best picture votes to Parasite. And I can't see Parasite not being in everybody's top two. I'm setting myself up for heartbreak. I think it's going to win. I think Parasite is going to take it.
All right. So I'll be Captain Cynic over here. And maybe I'm just a little raw from Green Book winning last year, but I just, as much as I love Parasite, I'll get to my heart pick in a minute, but as far as head picks go, I have a very hard time thinking that the same Academy that made Green Book its best picture last year is going to turn around and give a foreign film that you have to read best picture.
Oh,
that shifts genres. And that is not a slight of the film. That is a slight on the Academy. Yeah. I would love to be proven wrong. I would love for them to step out into something that I think is really unique. And I think is maybe the most unique film on this list. But I just, at the end of the day, I think honestly, there's going to be some people that don't even watch this movie, 'cause they're like, why do I need to watch some movie that has subtitles? Or why do I need
like aroma effect for you from aroma last year?
Very much so. Aroma effect in terms of, and not just, and even a little bit different and one step removed from Roma, which I think Parasite's a much better film than Roma is. Roma has that more kind of artistic, you know, it is one thing. It is easy to say what Roma is. Parasite is a harder movie to describe because of those tone shifts and genre shifts that we've talked about. So in my mind, when I picture an Academy of Odor, or I picture most, you know, kind of stodgy old white dudes, if I'm going to be just blunt about it. And those people en masse awarding Parasite Best Picture sounds wonderful. I just am very skeptical that it's going to happen, especially with a field this varied and this good. You're all right that in the terms of the tiered voting system, this could be a lot of people's second or third choices. And so maybe it sneaks in. I mean, hell, Moonlight beat La La Land a couple years ago. And you could argue, you know, La La Land's a far more traditional Academy friendly movie than Moonlight. So it's not, you know, and we gave the Fish movie a couple years ago Best Picture. So there's room for things that, you know, push the boundaries of genre, I think. But I'm still licking my wounds from a year ago, folks. What can I say? I've got green book PTSD. I don't know. So for that reason, I think it's going to be 1917. It's won so many awards leading up to this. It seems to have a very good consensus amongst pretty much every guild you can imagine. The Writers Guild, Producers Guild, Directors Guild. It's got all of that sort, that pedigree that it seems hard to me to see a shift happening at the last second. So my head pick is 1917. My heart pick is with Parasite, because I do think it is it's the movie to me that I think is not only of this moment, but will inspire future filmmakers, and we'll look back on 10 years from now and be like, yeah, that movie's still relevant. It holds up, and it really did change some stuff. I'd be super stoked and I'd go to bed very happy if a movie like Irishman or Marriage Story or even Little Women went home with Best Picture. I'd be cool with, you know, Once Upon a Time or Ford versus Ferrari. I'd be like, huh, if it was Joker or Jojo Rabbit. But
now just to clarify, Lou, you're not saying that 1917 is on par with Green Book, right?
No, not at all. I think okay. 1917 is a much better film than Green Book. But I feel, you know, they're both fairly mainstream films. One of them is really well made and technically masterful, and doesn't have any real problematic elements. And the other is Green Book.
The other is Green Book.
No. Don't misconstrue. I think all of the movies on this list, maybe save for Joker, I genuinely like his movies. I didn't like Green Book, so I'll be fine when 1917 wins. I just think that it's if I'm going to compare the two, I'd much rather see a Parasite win or even a Marriage Story win over that. But that's just me. All right. The last question I'm going to have you, how many Iowa caucus jokes are we going to get during the ceremony?
Oh man.
Over right under here. Five.
Hollywood doesn't believe in Iowa.
What are they going to say? What are they going to say more? Iowa caucus jokes or references to Endgame that they didn't want to actually award for anything, but they're going to use it as a cudgel to beat us over the head about cinema this year.
I don't know. There's no host. So, I mean, I guess the celebrities have to do it themselves.
Right. Somebody somewhere is going to make a joke about they still haven't tabulated the results, that the Best Picture app got screwed up, and they will think they're very clever.
Ooh. That's a good call.
I just realized this afternoon, I'm driving down to Springfield to be a part of the Front Row festivities, and I realize I hate the Oscar broadcast, which is kind of the point of that party. So is there will be alcohol?
There will be.
Okay.
Right. Will be. See you guys there.
Alcohol.
Oh, good. Well, all right. So about that.
Phil can be our resident Facebook liver. And he can just like talk about how bad the broadcast is.
Oh, every God. Statler and Waldorf in there one body.
Hey, if you're gonna watch something that you don't like, you might as well watch it with a group of friends, right?
That's right.
So, okay, but yeah. So speaking of, this is airing the same day. So the last call, everybody, for our big Oscar party tonight. At the Hoagland Center for the Arts. So you can watch the Oscars with us. You can react in real time with us. You can also follow us on our Facebook page for live updates all night, as well as our Twitter feed, Front Row Reviews with the Z. All sorts of fun times happening. Doors open at 6:30 and tickets are they $10, guys? All right, tickets are $10, so make sure you get those. Get on top of that. Enjoy the Oscar ceremony. Now that the Oscars I'm sure we'll do some sort of post-mortem when everything is done, and we'll dissect the winners and the losers and the surprises or the lack of them, and, you know, double over at all the wonderful Iowa caucus jokes that got made, and look forward to moving back on to kind of our regularly scheduled programming. I know Guilty Pleasures is going to be back in full force in February. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do, but we'll be back. All sorts of great stuff I know coming with classics and with flashbacks. Oh, I can tell you one thing we are doing. That just reminded me. I'm doing a crossover with Flashbacks celebrating the 30th anniversary of Tremors. So we are starting the first of a three-part miniseries where we're going to break down each two Tremors movies at a time for over three episodes. So Tremors 1 and 2 coming to you later this month. So enjoy that. Craig, you got anything going on with Beyond the Mouse?
We are. We're going to be talking about our trips that are coming up. We're going to be talking about all the movies. And we really haven't had a chance to dive into Disney Plus yet. We talked about what was going to be on there when it aired. But we have a lot of shows to catch up on now. We haven't really talked Mandalorian. We haven't talked a lot of other things. So
Encore, man.
It's going to be an exciting year. I also want to tease something for our sister podcast, After the Hype. They are rebranding themselves a little bit. And so you'll learn more about that as well. We can definitely send you over to athpod.com. We love them. We love all of the work that they're doing out in California. So look forward to seeing that as well.
Awesome. Jeremy, we got anything else with the Front Row at all?
Just a bunch of what you said. I mean, hearing the Tremor thing, I'm wondering why we've wasted our time with all these Oscar things. Yeah. So that's my main thought. But nope, just everything coming. And I can't wait for you to announce your bracket for March Movie Madness.
Oh, we've got a doozy. Actually, we got a couple of doozies we got to discuss. So we've had some fun in the thread debating about what our next big bracket's going to be, but that will be coming up. March is right around the corner. So yes, you can look out from that. Oh, and also make sure you hit up our website, frnpod.com, or you can actually find a lot of our stuff now on NPR Illinois, where you can see lots of different articles. I've got a couple of articles out there. If you haven't gotten enough Oscar coverage, you can check out my article comparing the Best Picture nominees to candidates in the Democratic primary.
It's amazing.
Thank you. And we can, and also I've got an article where I give you my ranked votings for Best Picture, and we will all, ultimately, there'll be an article coming out about why we can't stop arguing about Star Wars, and also my top 10 list of the best guilty pleasures of the decade. So lots of content to keep you through February and beyond. So thank you for listening to us. Enjoy your Oscar parties, everyone. Fill out those ballots. But until next time, for the Front Row Reviews, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Phil Rockwell.
I'm Craig McFarland.
I'm Jeremy Geckner.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.